If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Ballistic Behind the Curtain. It is our new WGN Plus show that you watch every Saturday at 10:30 and 4:30 p.m. and on Sundays at 4 o'clock p.m. following Mike Toomey's fantastic Laugh Tracks show. But here we focus in on the world of theater and the arts. And as you can see from the scenes you just watched, Hadestown is on its way to Chicago. This is a phenomenal show. It only got 14 nominations for Tonys back when it premiered and only won 8 of them. I mean, come on, in the 73rd Tony Award. So today we get to talk to one of the lead characters in the show. He plays the role of Orpheus. Wait, isn't that like an old... Yeah, it's just like what you're thinking of, that old... We're going to find out all about this. And joining me is Jose Contreras, who is on the road but headed to Chicago in this magical role. Jose, thanks for joining me. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Paul. I'm excited to be here.
So when Hadestown first came around, I was given the opportunity to invest in it. And I went, I don't know who's going to want to see this show. Big mistake on my part, because the investors have already recouped their investment. But for our viewers, tell them what Hadestown is all about.
Right. Hadestown is a love story for the ages. You know, it has its footing on the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, also bringing in Greek characters, Hades and Persephone. But really, it's about love. It's a story of young love, how we see with like Orpheus, who I play, and Eurydice, older love. And that's what audience members say when they come. We get a lot of like older guys that get like dragged along to the theater by their wives. And they're like, all right, I'll see what this is about. And then by the end of it, it's this rekindling of their connection that it's really special to see. And at the same time, you see like younger people going on like maybe a first date and they're like nervous about holding hands. And by the end of the show, like, it just deepens everybody's connection with love.
And it won, by the way, Tony, for the best original score. The music is so good.
Music is incredible.
Absolutely fantastic. You are, I mean, I don't know why, you know, you are the first Puerto Rican to play Orpheus, and we shouldn't have to kind of say those sort of things anymore, but it is true. It is something, it's an accomplishment. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of changed the world of casting some years ago with Hamilton. And in fact, by the way, I know you're from Puerto Rico. Your family lives there. Am I right? You're going to be at the CIBC Theater. Your family's coming back from Puerto Rico, where they first came in to see Hamilton, and now they're going to see their son as Orpheus in Hadestown.
Yeah, my parents flew to Chicago to see Hamilton, I think back in 2019. And I mean, Hamilton's, it was everything. I was obsessed with it. I'm still obsessed with Hamilton. but it is really crazy when I saw what the ending tour date was and had a conversation with them to realize the parallel that like 5-6 years later, the last time they were there to see this like groundbreaking show, now the next time they get to see me in the same venue in a leading role, like we all cried when we were talking about it. It was just really special.
And it's going to be special. And they're, when they get here, the original roles, of course, Andre de Shields, was magnificent in his lead in this show. And Reeve Carney, who people may remember as Spider-Man and whatever on Broadway, but Reeve Carney and his now fiance played the lead roles. I'm sort of curious. You realize that means since you've got the Reeve Carney role, you could end up with a permanent relationship out of this. That seems to be the history here.
Meg Colton, who plays Eurydice, she's lovely to work with. And really connecting with her on stage is one of my favorite parts. She's a very electric actor. She keeps it very alive for me. Like sometimes she's a little bit warmer as Eurydice. Sometimes she can be a little bit feistier, and it really keeps like my Orpheus on his toes. And I really love the energy playing off of her and the rest of the cast.
And while the show itself brings us these sort of classic myths that will be familiar, I think, to people if you went to high school at all or anywhere else. But the truth is, this show it's deeper than that. I mean, as I've seen it several times, it's really about social inequality. Arguably, it's even about climate change. I mean, there's just a lot of current issues that come into this play. Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. I mean, In fact, just the stop right before where we are now, we were in El Paso, Texas, and we were performing 20 minutes away from the Mexican border, singing Why We Build the Wall. Ah. You know, and it's hard not to take all of the layers that come with that. But this actually, people often will text me when they come see the show, or they think like, oh, it was Hades based off of certain political figures of great controversy at the moment. And no, like this, that song and these characters, they're from a 2010 concept album that has developed, but that song was in the original 2010 album. And that just goes to show like how much of this language is circular and how many of these issues are like timeless and will continue to repeat themselves over and over again until we wake up to what is happening.
Well, and what you say is so important, because what it means is the messages of this show and the themes are resonating today, making it current. When you meet people after the show or, you know, at the stage door, that kind of thing, do people talk to you about the fact of how relevant this show has become today? Or do they kind of separate and isolate the current politics out of this show, which, as you said, was not written to reflect any of that?
I'd say it's a good mix. I love a lot of the times when we do talkbacks with audience members, some of those deeper points come up where people are asking like what our interpretation of the material is, or like sometimes wondering what the original intention of the show is. And people get a lot of really cool fan theories about the characters that actually we take after, and we're like, oh wait, that was kind of a good character analysis. Maybe we should bring that into the performance a little bit more. So the people that come to see the show, very smart. And yeah, like you said, the themes, they're just so reflective of everything that's happening today in a way that truly is timeless. Like there's always something to talk about.
And you're going to find, by the way, Chicago audiences are seen by many producers, many performers as really very, and I don't just say this because I'm a Chicagoan, but we're a pretty sophisticated theater audience. We don't go because we're tourists. We go because we know theater and we love theater. And you're going to sense that. Plus the CIBC, where you're coming, of course, you'll be on the same stage, right, that Hamilton was on. That's going to mean something. But at the same time, it's sort of an intimate space, more so than some of the larger sort of classic theaters that are down the street from where you're going to be. But that being said, your character, other characters in the show, they're flawed. They have weaknesses. They're human beings. And that all plays out as well.
Yeah. Without giving too many spoilers, my character has a pretty significant flaw near the end of the show.
Yes.
and the show really starts with the line that introduces Orpheus is like, Orpheus was a poor boy, but he had a gift. He could make you see how the world could be. So Orpheus is this very endearing optimist who just wants to make the world better. But throughout the course of the show, he has to shed some of that in order to take on this epic challenge, you know? And it shows how the characters are imperfect and are vulnerable and susceptible to change. And it's in that transformation. It's that transformation that makes them so electric, but also like reflects what you said, like these characters are flawed.
And I think it's also true, but there's value. I mean, I think the show tells us there's value in trying, even if the result is failure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the last song in the show. You know, it's an old song, but we're going to sing it again. And we do. And we get back up on a stage and we do it again and again and again. And there's always something new in the retelling. Like there's always a new moment. There's always a new lyric that pops out. There's always, depending on where we are, like different songs that feel highlighted. We have swings and understudies. And sometimes like when they're in on a roll, they talk about like, oh, for some reason doing this track in the show really made me feel connected to the love in the show. This track really made me feel connected to the adversity in the show. Listening to this song from this angle made me feel empowered in a new, special way. So it just has so many layers, like even in the show, across characters, across tracks, across everything. You know, that's just some of the magic of Aeneas and the music that she wrote.
So fantastic that this show is making its way back to Chicago because it's been a while. It's going to be at the CIBC Theater, a theater you're going to love and historic for you to be playing in and your family as they visit you from May 6th to May 18th. It's not a long run, May 6th to May 18th, but get your tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. You do not want to miss Hadestown, and you do not want to miss Jose Contreras in this critical role of Orpheus. I can't wait to see you. Jose, thanks for your time, and I look forward to seeing you on stage. Break leg, as they say, and we'll be back with another show right after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back, everybody, to Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. We shift our attention now to an incredible play that you do not want to miss. It's playing at the North Shore Center for Performing Arts, and it is called Prayer for the French Republic. I'll be honest, the name might be a little off-putting, because what is this all about? We're about to tell you what it's about. I have lots of cast members here, and the director of the show, you'll meet them all in a moment, but this show is so important today with this message. Jeremy Wexler, you, of course, are the director of this show, but also the founding artistic director of Theater Wit, one of the co-producers of this show, along with Northlight Theater. Jeremy, what's this show all about?
This show follows a French family over five generations. As they kind of confront a rising tide of anti-Semitism that had attracted Joshua Harmon, the author's attention with the Charlie Hebdo shootings, which was a satirical newspaper that was shot up. And then one of those gunmen then went to a kosher supermarket and opened fire, killing four Jews who were out shopping for groceries. And he saw this rising tide of anti-Jewish sentiment in France, then getting directly paralleled here in the U.S. And so that was the kind of inspiration for this commission, where he ended up writing this story that stretches from 1944 to 2017.
Sounds like it didn't have a lot to do with the world today, but actually he wrote it, I believe, in 2022. And with that being the case, here we are in 2025, where it resonates so very strongly. Let's meet a lot of the cast members, not all, but a lot of the cast members here. Janet Ulrich Brooks, one of my favorite Chicago actors in all the world, probably one of your classic roles, The Audience, is what I picked to introduce you. Janet, where you play Queen Elizabeth here, you're kind of like a queen, but not Elizabeth. Here you play Marcel Salomon. Tell us a bit about your character and her role as the kind of matriarch of the generation.
Oh, Marcel is a mom, and she is passionate about what her son is going through with the anti-Semitism where he teaches in the town he teaches in, and how it's coming. And then her husband, who wants to leave and wants to move, and she wants to stay. And she has a daughter who is manic depressive, but very brilliant. And there's just a lot that she's dealing with, and was raised rather secular. So she really wasn't a strict Jew, or she didn't follow traditions until she married a Sephardic man. And then little by little, then her son becomes much more religious. And so they take on the traditions and that sort of thing. And then, you know, it becomes so important for the whole family to hang on to those traditions. And then there's a clashing, of course, with her brother, with her family, and with her past. And, you know, do you stay or do you go? And I mean, how fortunate this family is to even have the means to make that choice. You know, I think of all the people in the world who don't even have that, you know, that the ability to make that choice, and how tragic that is, that we can't all get along.
True. And your brother, played in the show by Larry Graham, who's an amazing actor,
he's amazing,
from Red Orchard Theater and other places, not with us today. But let's meet your husband in the show, Ram Bakhradar. We last fell in love at the band's visit, Ram. That show, up at Writers Theater, so good. But talk about your role as Charles. You are indeed Marcel's husband.
Yeah, Charles Benhamou offers a different perspective on the family. He is originally from French Algeria and has immigrated, which means he is a rare Arab Jew. And I say rare because probably rare in the sense of the United States or here. In France, not so rare, being a Sephardic Jew, I guess most of the Jewish population can trace their ancestry back to Northern Africa, Western Africa, and in those former French colonies. So he's immigrated to France in the 60s when he was a kid, brought the Sephardic values and traditions with him, grew up, fell in love, married Marcel, Janet's character. She then, of course, converted to Judaism in the traditional way. They raised their kids. They're living the best French life they can. They're both doctors. She's a psychiatrist, and I'm not even quite sure what kind of. It's just a general practitioner, probably. But he starts having visceral reactions to things that he's seeing in France, like, well, his son getting beaten up and people looking at him in awful ways. And since he is sort of challenging the social sort of structure by wearing his kippah, his yarmulke all the time. So he starts boiling over and seeing the familiarities between what happened in the 60s in Algeria, what is happening in present day Paris and France. And he has a panic attack and then just says, listen, we got to get out of here. We got to go to Israel. And then that sets off the sort of the domino effect of the rest of the play.
And indeed, you have two children. We go to the son, played by Max Stewart, Daniel, and Max. Of course, I have to give you both Southern Gothic and Noises Off for both of those because they're short titles, so I can say both. But talk about your role, because in many ways, you are the impetus for a lot of what this family then has to deal with because of your beliefs and how they've developed, although we're never quite sure how they developed. There's all competing theories.
Sure. Yeah, to me, like, Daniel has like a restlessness like in his spirit, and like at the beginning of the play, he's trying to calm that through religion, and you meet him after he'd just been attacked for being Jewish. And in the course of the play, I think he's battling this like chaos in his heart and trying to figure out how to calm that, and, you know, falls in love with his seventh cousin, you know, and then wants to move, doesn't want to move, very uncertain. And I think from there, that feeling is sort of like moves into the family and everyone's affected by these thoughts and feelings about life that Daniel has.
And this cousin, by the way, that you mentioned, she's come from the United States.
Spent
some time. Becomes a means for getting a lot of this story and the dynamics told as we learn about that relationship. I think it's also amazing because clearly she's learning French, and I was translating to my partner so he understood the French and English until he explained they're talking English. But anyways, they're not really speaking French. No, I'm kidding. But anyway, although I do speak some French, let's leave the year 2016, 2017, go back to the 1940s and meet the matriarch of the family then, looking very different out of makeup, I must say.
Thank you.
Yeah, I guess that is a compliment. I didn't, I guess so. But you look fabulous in your costume as well. Kathy Scambiaterra. Did I say that right?
You did.
Oh, good for me. You play
like perfectly.
You play perfectly. Half Italian, maybe. I don't know. You play Irma. So tell us a little, because we're back in the 40s when we visit with you and your family.
Yes, we're back in 1944 and 45. And I'm Irma Salomon. And I'm the great, great grandmother of Marcel and Patrick. So we're going back. And we're right in the middle of the war. And at first, when we're in first meet my husband Adolphe and myself, we're in occupied Paris, and we have not been taken due to a superintendent or a person who says their old people don't take them, and they don't, but my three children are gone. Lucien, Robert have been taken, but Jacqueline has left Paris before they stopped letting people out, and she went to Cuba. So that part of the family is safe. And I don't know, we don't know where the other Lucien and Robert are. And of course, then we move to 45 when there's liberation and the camps are liberated. And my son Lucien comes home with my grandson Pierre, and Irma, really needs to know what happened to them and what happened to the girls, because only half the family is there. The other half did not return with them. And so lots of fear. And of course, Irma doesn't know what we know now. Irma doesn't know. And so the search for the truth and how that all unfolds.
Let's meet one of your sons, the son who does come back that we get to meet, played by Alex Wiseman, who plays Lucien. Alex, the last time we talked, you were not able to tell the audience that you were then cast in Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, but on Broadway, now we can tell them because it's done. But anyway, talk about Lucien, because you come back. I will say one thing. You don't want to talk about the experiences that you went through. My dad was in World War II, and he never wanted to talk about the experiences that he experienced as a military man. Talk about Lucien.
Yeah. So Lucien is Irma and Adolf's son, one of three children. And, you know, this family is sort of, all five generations of this family are sort of centered around this piano store, this piano business. And Lucien is the son who sort of takes that business under his wing before the war. And when the war is starting up, and signs are around for Jewish families to sort of get out while you can, Lucien opts not to do that in order to protect the family business. And that decision, the decision to stay, is what leads to him being arrested and then spending 2 years in the camp. And the echoes of that decision are sort of what launch us on the great debate in the modern family. You know, do we stay, do we go? We have this, you know, literally on stage, the example of the family who decided to stay and what a bad idea that was. And for Lucien, you know, he arrives at the camp and the first thing that happens is his wife and two children get put into another line and he never sees them again. And he and his son get put into one line and they persevere and they survive. And like many, many survivors in all the documentaries and books that I read for this, he doesn't want to talk about it. And he's got a real sense of optimism and purpose coming out of it. And for him, that purpose goes back to the pianos. And we get this real sense that he was able to figure out his way to survive in order to come back and sell these pianos. Of course, it's 1945.
Right.
Everyone in France is on rations. No one wants to buy a piano. And he sort of has to grapple with this idea of, what have I survived for?
The presence of the piano, which lasts through just a little time left, so I want to make sure we get a little more in. First of all, Jeremy, let me come back to you, which is, not only is this play, I've been talking about it since I saw it, but can you very briefly talk about, there are other events people can go online and see that address the issues of anti-Semitism and related issues.
Yeah, so we have a whole kind of lecture series that runs through the 9th of May. We've got people coming in from all over the country, all over the world. We had speakers from the Sorbonne and Yale and a huge host of college professors. We have an online conversation with Joshua Harmon, the playwright, and Itamar Moses about being playwrights in America. So we're trying to look at it from all sorts of perspectives. What is it? What are the lessons we can learn from history that we can apply to the present day? What are the roles of Jews in our current society? What is society's current relationship and how is that changing here in America to Jews? The play asks a lot of questions about that I think American Jews we've been off the hook for asking, particularly around questions of our personal safety, our cultural safety, and what does it mean these days to be in the cultural minority or a cultural minority here in the U.S.?
And growing up, and sadly with our time gone now, but growing up in Skokie as I did, surrounded by Holocaust survivors in every direction of my home, a question raised near the end of the play that people will just have to, I've been pondering it since, as we always do, but it's, why do they hate us? Raising questions as who's the they and what is the reason behind this? It's an issue that it just has gone on through the ages, not just in the 40s and into today, but it goes back further than that. Prayer for the French Republic is playing extended through May 18th at the North Shore Center for Performing Arts. Tickets can be gotten at northlight.org. You all are fantastic. I need to have like an hour with you all again, and I'm so sorry we don't, but I encourage everybody to see it. It is 3 hours long. You'll wish it was five. Thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it. And thanks for our audience for watching us here on Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. We will see you next week. All right, we return on Behind the Curtain with a little bonus add-on here because the TV show only gives us a certain amount of time, and my cast is with me as well as the director. I want to do a little bit more. I mentioned at the end of the TV part that the question raised at the end of the show is, why do they hate us? Janet, from your role in this perspective, I mean, is that it's just your character, but I wonder whether you too, it's just something that we've pondered for the ages.
Right. And it is when you, you know, my character, Marcel, she says, I'm French, you know, she's more French than Jewish is how she feels at the, you know, during at the time. But, you know, then there's that passion trying to keep the family together. And yeah, why do they? And I think there's a lot of good points made in the play. You have to come see it so you hear them. And but that is something that when I look at the world, it just boggles my mind that we can't, as human beings, evolve and get over this. You're this, I'm that, you're that, and therefore I must hate you. That's history. That's every. And now it's, you know, it's gender, it's all kinds of issues. So
that's what's so important. And Ram, let me come to you, which is, yes, this is about anti-Semitism and deals with that, but you can't help but sit in the audience and walk out and just go, today, pick your topic. I mean, this is just, you know, where is it safe? But I want to, my question for you at this point, you as Charles, as the father, can you, is it your determination that your desire to leave France, to get out of here and move to Israel, by the way, which we learn, is it about Rom and his background and his experience? In the show, we get the sense, no, it's all about Daniel. It's all about your son. Is it?
Oh, boy. A lot of it is. I mean, as a father and as a husband, he obviously wants to keep his family as safe as possible. And as I said earlier, he has a visceral reaction to the violence that has been taken out on his son. And he sees that as just the tip of the iceberg of things to come. So and then me as Rom reacting to that, it's like, oh, sure, this could be, you know, any culture. It could be any religion, especially right now. After one of the previews, a woman from the audience came up to me, I think this was during a talk back, and said, you know, she said, listen, I'm not Jewish, but I feel this for like every person who feels under the thumb of some kind of persecution. And this could have been in a Catholic family, it could have been a Muslim family, it could have been. I mean, we are obviously showing the Jewish side of why they hate us, but it's like, exactly, who is they? Why do they hate us? How long has this been going on? How can we just stop it?
And by the way, you triggered something else, but and Kathy, I'm coming to you, but I got to go to Jeremy for this, which is, look, as somebody who is Jewish, it resonated with me in very, you know, personal ways, obviously. But, and everybody, that I've sent people there, and another friend of mine, Al Breslaw from around the town, Chicago, his wife only goes to musicals because she can't stay awake and plays. I said, no, you need to take her to this. And both of them, all 3 hours, loved it. Jeremy, my question for you is, for folks who say, well, I'm not Jewish, I don't relate to it. I think it's a play for everybody. I know you do too, but give a reason for folks watching us now who, you know, may not be Jewish and don't relate to that piece of it. Why do they need to come see this show?
When we hear stories about, you know, let's take the current story of, like, must get rid of all the previously illegal immigrants, now immigrants in general, I think we have to contextualize that in a personal fashion. When you hear that, you know, 4,000 people emigrated to so-and-so, it's not like geese flying instinctively across the border. It's 4,000 individual difficult personal decisions made by all these families for their own reasons. They're always for clear and present reasons. Relocating and emigrating is hard. Leaving even, you know, the city you live in to move to another city is hard, let alone moving across the country. So when we think about these blanket statements from that we're hearing from the current administration today, we really have to contextualize them as individual life choices, and we all have to make those. In addition, the lessons of history cannot be lost on the present, and not specifically in relation to the Jewish community. You can look at the actions of the Vichy government and see direct, like, sentence for sentence parallels in terms of what's happening with the current administration's statements. The same way they're redefining the question of what it is to be a citizen, what rights do you have as these minority groups, they keep shifting the bar. This is a playbook straight out of, 1937, 38, 39, from the Vichy government. It's word for word in some cases. So the past is uncomfortably close to us now here in this country. And so I think it's the combination of the political reality in which we swim, as well as the intense and moving personal stories that I think lifted up for current audience.
By the way, on the day that I saw it, there is a line in the show in the 2000s family which says there something like that. Well, I might be you, Ram, who says this, but who basically says. Or no, it might be Larry. You can still have a Democratic election and still elect a monster as president. Who has that line?
Ray has it. Ray Gray.
Okay.
Ray Gray. Yeah.
So, out of curiosity, when I saw it, the audience erupted into applause in recognition. That I'm seeing by nodding. That happens a lot.
Every night. Yeah.
Okay.
The playwright has this unique. Joshua Harmon has a track record of finding these kind of tension points in the kind of national discourse. And writing plays that explode out 2 years later into the present. It's so immediate. It is crazy to me that he wrote the play. The initial drafts that I read were in 2018. It premiered in 2023, 2022. It then reopened in 2023. I mean, and yet each successive year, much to my dismay, the play becomes more and more present. So I think it is a kind of electric play for this moment in our culture.
Another reason for people to see it, regardless of religion or anything else. Kathy, so I'm curious, as an actor, your mindset has to be in the 40s. That's where this is taking place. And you share with us the difficulty of not knowing where your family is. Although I'll be honest, I mean, I thought I knew a fair amount about the history and the fact that they tell the story that you were saved with the comment of you don't take old people and stuff. I actually didn't know if that was true because lots of old people were killed by the Nazis. But but be that as it may, just, I mean, how do you, and I'll come to Alex for you on this as well. I mean, you have to have your mindset in the 40s. You know what you know today in 2025, but
yes.
You put yourself in the 1945 mindset, right?
Yes, yes.
You have a husband named Adolf, probably wasn't easy back then either. I don't know, but go ahead.
Adolf.
Adolf.
But yes, there's, just yesterday, cast member Henson asked me, don't you think Irma has an inkling of what has happened to the girls? And it is very difficult with our mindset now not to know. And I have this one thing about, the imagination. I have 2 years of losing my mind, imagining where the children are, right? And, it's hard to go there, to think they might be gone. But the idea that even nowadays, we cannot get our head around how the extermination camps operated. It's still beyond imagination. It's so hard not to know, but if you can put yourself, I am not knowing, I have that whole thing about that. It's horrific when it comes your way finally.
Max, let's take it back into the 2000s, and then I'm going to come to you, Alex, for that same kind of reflection. But so for Max, your character, again, there's some question as to why it is your character becomes as devout as he is. It could be a relationship. It could be something else. I don't know if we really know, but talk to me about, you do wear a kippah throughout the show. You do experience the anti-Semitism violence out in front. What is it when you had to study this character? So much of what I've seen you in prior are comedies or much lighter shows. How much of a challenge is it to play this kind of, because this just isn't drama. This takes you to the center of some pretty tough experiences that your character has been through.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I felt like I found Josh's writing very funny. Like there's a pace to it that is comedic that I think that was kind of my way into understanding like the way Daniel talks and thinks, like the way he cuts himself off, the pace at which he talks. So understanding like the tone kind of helped me get into the, you know, the his mindset, which is like a mindset of a lot of anxiety and a desperate need to connect to something greater than himself, which is something that I totally can identify with. But yeah, I don't know. It a lot of the writing is so good that it kind of does feel effortless. And there's a lot of research that, you know, went into this role and everything. But also something very pure about Daniel and the way he believes in God. That's like, you know, the source is the source, and like the rhetoric he uses to get there is a Jewish rhetoric and Jewish traditions, but it's the same source that everyone's kind of searching for. And so, like, you know, he doesn't want to be involved in the headlines or the political stuff. He doesn't want his mom to call the police because it's not really about that. You know, it's just like about this like pure wanting to connect to something.
Larger. Is that what it's about, or is it about a fear that he has for retribution if she did call the police?
I mean, I guess you could say both. I mean, to me, it feels like that's not what it's about. I think it's about, yeah, wanting to, yeah, not be a part of that, because it's not, that's a whole different thing than God and like connecting to something larger than yourself. The political stuff and like what happens in the headlines and what happens in the news can be its own sort of narrative that has nothing to do with the internal connection that you have with yourself, I think.
Okay. And Alex, so here's the question that might be tough for you to answer, but when you come in, so we heard your mom, you know, talking about what it's like not knowing where your kids are and all of that. When you come back in this show, you're between two generations. You're the generation that she was worried about, but you've also come home to parents who were spared. Not to mention a son in this situation. Can you just talk about the I don't know if it's a dilemma, but the nature of what's it like to be like, I've got parents spared. I've got a kid who was, you know, going through this. I don't even want to talk about what you're this intergenerational, connective generational character.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's very easy to, imagine that there's a resentment there.
Towards your mom?
Towards my parents for avoiding the whole thing. But that resentment's not really in the script. It's not really what Josh is interested in. And so we've, you know, it was figuring out a way to, rather than blame them or hold anything against them for not experiencing what my family, the family that I'm the patriarch of experienced. But then it became about protection. And how can I protect them from even the knowledge of this? And, you know, sort of adding on to what Kathy said, it was very hard for me as an American Jew who's been learning about the Holocaust since third grade Hebrew school, to imagine that there was a time where any Jew across the country didn't know everything about these concentration camps. And so early on, when I was working on this script, it was like, well, how do they not know? How can they not know this? But it was a real experiment in jumping back into that mindset of like, okay, well, if they don't know, not only do I not want to be the one to tell them, but Kathy and I watched this documentary where this woman was like, when I got home, I never cried again, because if I started crying, I would never be able to stop. There's a steeliness and a silence that says, we're just not going to talk about it, and we're just going to move forward because I'm here. And so let's talk about tomorrow, and we're never going to talk about yesterday.
And there's only about, I think, 200 Holocaust survivors left today. Actually, when we're talking is the day of remembrance for that. And I had a neighbor. I used to live on Oakdale, and she lived upstairs, and she had her little basset hound named Dudley, and she was cute and whatever. And one day I open up the Sunday Sun Times, and there's this 3-page spread on her. I had no idea. It turns out she was married to a guy named Peter Gadiel, who created the Brox logo. And the story was because she was going to Washington to be honored. I had no idea she was a Holocaust survivor. She was a happy lady who walked her dog all the time as a widow. I won't go through the story except to say when I saw that, I called her and I said, Renee, I had no idea. Can I talk to you? She said, come on up. I'll make you coffee. And she told me the story. Only one part of it had to do with when they were being hidden by a family under the floor and her son sneezed and the Nazis found them. and shot her son in front of her. Those are the stories. And it's and so, as you say, Alex, how do people not know this? How does this get lost? How do you have deniers who come into play? Jeremy, I'm curious, the kind of discussion we're having now and the what Alex saw in his own character. As a director, did you sit down with the cast at any point and like give Alex a chance to say, hey, I see this, but it's not in the script?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of that texturing is essential to making these characters of this depth, right? And it's not that Josh is insensible of these other issues. There are references, there are little glancing references to all of these issues in line. So sometimes it's just an O. There's just there's a lot of kind of moments where these things get glanced off of, but that's, you know, again, not what the characters are doing at the moment, but we have to know it's there. That's why, you know, the scenes are so fascinating, is because of all the complicated agendas that people are bringing to this space. And so, yeah, you have to go into all of these minute details in rehearsal all the time.
Yeah. We'll wrap up just a little bit. But, Jen, I wanted to ask you, I mean, the show is set in Paris for obvious reasons, the Charlie Hebdo thing and the things that triggered it. Could, from your point of view, because I could see you being a mom in New York, too, could this have been set in the United States for you? Or is it pretty important we needed to move it out of this country?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on one hand, it could be set anywhere, you know, anywhere where there are, you know, are Jews. But I think the...
But is it a buffer in some ways for us?
Helps, I think it helps our audiences in America have it be in France, because it separates just a little bit to where they're watching it happen somewhere else. And maybe then bringing those events and possibilities and concerns back home and connecting them. Like when the applause comes out about, you know, electing a monster in a democratic country, you know, immediately there's that... there was only one night where there was just a smattering, and I thought, who's here? But that kind of thing, it allows our audiences to say, oh, this, I can connect these things to me rather than living in them. There's a, like a separation. I don't know. Does that make sense? You can cut it out.
Alex,
I don't
know. Alex is going to chime in.
Yeah, do you mind if I chime in? I do think that there is, and I think the play tackles this so brilliantly, a different experience of being an American Jew and a European Jew.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
Because
yes.
even if you are, as we all are, most of us, descendants from Jews in Europe or Russia or Ukraine, no one was in an apartment in America, got a knock, and a Nazi was there and took him to a camp. Right. The way that the very apartment that Marcel and her family are living in, that could have happened it. And while that is happening today in America to another, yes, you know, oppressed minority.
Another other.
Wow, well said. The Jewish experience of like walking on the wooden slats of a family that was taken, that is not an American experience. So I think for that reason, the play has to take place in Europe.
Elodie has a large in her bar scene a lot of information of the difference between the American Jew and the French Jew, and how the American Jews have not had to feel those same that same immediacy. There's a separation. Feeling safe.
I would say that, you know, Joshua and I spoke right after the Unite the Right rally in 2017, where I watched this on television and thought to myself, oh my God, look at these unapologetic white nationalist Nazis, unmasked, chanting, Jews will not replace us, and death to Jews, broadcasting on their social media. And I thought to myself, on the one hand, I'm in Chicago, so I've got some physical distance from this danger. But what would it be like if I lived in Charlottesville? It's not that big a city. Like, am I looking at this video thinking, oh my God, that's Frank from the coffee shop? Like, who? And then how immediate does that make it feel? And what do you do as a member of this group in that environment? And how do you make decisions? Would I want to move? My relationship to the city in which I lived would have fundamentally altered if I'd lived there because of that event. And that's the kind of tumult that these characters are experiencing. What happens when the place you are inherently starts to feel unsafe. How do you negotiate that? How do you decide what to do? How does it change you as a person? I've told the cast this story, but it always sticks with me, is after the Tree of Life shootings, where those Jews were gunned down at the synagogue. I was talking to the playwright again, and he said, you know, he went to synagogue the following weekend, and the rabbi said, well, I'm not really ready to talk about this tragedy. It's too new, it's too raw. But if you look around, you can see we have armed guards. I hope you can feel safe. But the events of this last weekend remind us all that to be American and Jewish is to be white until you are not. And this phrase really stuck with me. It was this kind of organizing principle of thinking about, you know, the othering and how this occurs. And as you see all these groups that don't even have that kind of light protection of assimilation around just cosmetically, you know, what is it like to navigate those waters? What do you do if fundamentally it's possible that the place you're in is inimically hostile, that you could be surrounded by violence that could happen at any time, and you move through that environment, and how does that change you? How does it change, yes, Alex returning to this place where, you know, his own government, it was the Vichy government, not the Nazis who were collecting people, it was the French police, right? The French police were collecting Jews off the streets. And so what happens when you're walking through the streets of Paris and there's French policemen? What do you think to yourself? They're the ones who participated in it. They did it. They're there directing traffic still untouched by this crime. So, you know, all of those kind of little anxiety points accumulate. And how do we as people navigate it? And how do people have to navigate it daily? You know, you watch students terrified to, you know, leave class because they're afraid they're getting, you know, picked up by ICE. You know, how do you go to class knowing that random street cars on the street might be a van and some people are going to jump out of it and grab you? You know, how do you get through your day? And that's the question the characters have to ask themselves.
Yeah, I wonder if there's people who could be asked that question today.
Well, yes.
Or being grabbed off the street.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. Right now.
Exactly. Right.
Right now. It's happening.
I want to just for a moment talk about the symbolism of the piano. Ram, I'm going to come to you in a moment, but I want to ask Max this because Max plays guitar. He doesn't play piano. I don't think he plays piano. And there is this constant theory that takes us back generations as well about this issue of selling pianos and who's going to sell them and who's going to not. Curious, Max, did you take that as it's a job thing? This is what I want to do? Or is the symbolism deeper there when it comes to the meaning of the piano in this show? Because it's prevalent throughout.
You mean having the store in Paris?
Well, you can take it as you wish to, but I'm thinking just the presence of the piano throughout these generations. And I get that it's the family business, but, you know, that didn't have to be the business. The business could have been anything. Could have been a butcher shop, you know, that was playing through. But does the presence of the piano, the fact that your character Danny chooses not to play it, not to sell it, whatever, does that have any more meaning than it is what it is to you?
I mean, there's the meaning. There's the symbolism of music, and it's not a butcher shop, and it's a piano shop, you know. But I think ultimately it's like at the end where I'm like, no one wants to keep the store running. I mean, it's a family stake, and it's like an established tradition, and like our heart and our generations go back, and we're just gonna give that up to leave for Israel. And yeah, it's like the letting go of what we are as a family, and then, you know, reckoning with the fact that we have to leave that in order to stay a family and stay safe.
I think it's just because that's the way. And of course, Pierre, your son, Alex, in the show, who's not with us today, but ends up at the piano, and it becomes a very powerful thing. There's reasons he goes to the piano to disrupt what is going on. Jeremy, am I off? But you're the best. You're the director. Am I off base to think of this piano as being a very symbolic thing in this show, or is it really just a mechanism in the show?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, one, it is an instrument, but it's a non-portable instrument. It's not a piccolo shop, right? It's a piano shop. And we hear that one of the key reasons the family didn't leave is all their money and resources were tied up in this in these pianos. It is a reason they stayed and paid the price. Lost half the family because the resources that they had were tied up in this physical asset that could not readily be moved. And then Lucien comes back to try to sell the pianos to at least justify in some way this sacrifice that was made, and then finds out that they were all purchased by Nazis and shipped back to Germany, which is quite a moment for him. So pianos are traditionally seen as these kind of heritage family items. People like to pass them along and pass them down, and they have a certain weight to them. People do not like to get rid of pianos. Sometimes they have to. They're moving. They're what have you. They're very difficult to kind of manage. But they are a kind of family heirloom. My grandmother had, two grand pianos in not a super large apartment, and she herself was an indifferent piano player. She had inherited one of them. She bought another one for her children. They passed down to, her daughters. The question of what will happen to these pianos is sitting with the family. Like, they have the weight of history and tradition with them, as well as for this family. It is the thing that moved this family from the lower class to the middle class. It is the success story of the family in their kind of upward rise, was the fact that they had 22 piano stores around France. It speaks to success, to assimilation, and upward mobility, and the success of this kind of French dream, which then is a weight around their neck that brings them down.
And Kathy, I'm coming to you. I just want to say, I have in my living room, a baby grand, and it's a Steck, a George Steck, and it was made in Germany in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And I've just always kind of wondered. I don't know what I'm wondering, but it's just always sort of been with me of what the history this piano has seen.
Yes.
Since that time. But Kathy, go ahead.
I love the piano because it's Irma's piano. And it was built for Irma. And of course, her grandson learns to play on it. And then it goes through the generation and becomes Marcel's. And it's such a tactile object that family members have actually touched. And that I love that connection. And it stays in the room. It's the connective tissue that's in the room, that's physically in the room, that I just find so powerful.
Yeah, some of you may know I'm a collector of things. I mean, I have like Abraham Lincoln's hair and stuff. And there's something about that very thing, which is like, this was on the guy's head, or George Washington. It might be a little weird. But I also have Lin-Manuel Miranda's original boots from Hamilton. That's a different kind of tactile. But but anyway, Ron, let me ask you, first of all, do you have a provision in your contract that requires every show to one way or another bring you to the Middle East and Israel?
Since 9/11, yeah, kind of.
Fans visit, whatever, So I got to ask you this question. I don't know how to do this without, I'm going to not give something away. There's a bit of, I think it's a surprise at the end of the show, something that the audience sees, and I don't know that we know it's coming. So if I'm wrong, and you all can give it away if you want to, but something that happens. And I'm sort of curious from your character, there's something about Charles that, yes, you're the father, you're in there, but there's something outside of this family that is you for me. There's just this emotional thing that happens. So the end of the show, there's an interaction. And I'm sort of curious, does Charles have thoughts about the life of a particular character that you're interacting with? Because the audience knows more about that character than you probably do, that Charles probably does. I'm trying not to be obtuse with that, but am I asking enough for you to pick up on the question of what I'm trying to ask?
Honestly, I'm not picking it up.
Can I, Jeremy, I don't know. You're a director. Can I give away what I'm talking about?
Well, yes. At least give poor Ron a couple names, a couple details so he can contextualize this.
So I'm talking about Pierre.
Oh, okay.
And there's Pierre at one point and Pierre at another point. Yeah. And again, the lowest on end of the pedal. And I know this is a good question to ask Janet, but I'm asking you because you can seem to sort of observe him, unlike Janet, who would have grown up. So with that, what is Charles' view of Pierre's view of the world?
Boy, Charles. I mean, the interactions that he has with mature Pierre, as we call him, is like, look, you were a father. I was a father. You wanted to protect your family. I want to protect your family. And it's interesting you bring up Pierre, because in that one long monologue that Mature Pierre gives, it's interesting. Maybe it's just the way that we're blocked. He's giving a lot of that to my character, to Charles. I don't know if it was just easier to look at me at that point.
That's why I'm asking. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of that is directed towards to Charles as the person that has really started the ball rolling on, boy, we're going to Israel.
Is he the one that has the lesson that needs to be taught? I mean, maybe he's the one Pierre thinks needs to learn here.
Possibly. Yeah.
Let me ask it this way, Janet. Does Marcel know the history, do you think?
The part that Jeremy was talking about with us that I don't know is that that he did not want to sell the pianos, that he did not want to go into the family business. That's what I didn't know. And so I'm most taken with the information about, you know, hearing his mother from wherever people go when they're gone and telling him to study something else. And the need then, the need to stay together. And, you know, I think Marcel passionately does want her family to stay together. She'd do anything for her son, as Irma would for for Lucien, you know, or for her grandson. So, but that's the part of it that I don't know. I think I know some other things, but I, you know, I don't know details of anything. No, he hasn't told me that, but okay. I do know that piano store is really important to him and that it brings him joy. And so I'm very taken with also then at the end of his speech, when he is saying, that's why I'm there. I go there and I see our name and I see, you know, they're all with me. And I have a moment where I kind of think, oh, maybe we should stay and keep the pianos, you know, keep the store. It's not a clear cut decision to go. It's complicated.
And it's interesting. Yes. It's interesting. Max, as you answered that question too, I mean, I think as Danny, you're answering it kind of the way your mother, it's what your mother would have taught you through the years. I'm taking it somewhere deeper. I think Jeremy, you're saying, yes, we can go deeper with it, but I'm not sure your characters necessarily understood, which is the purpose of Irma and the purpose of Lucienne. I mean, that's why I know more than you do in the audience than you do in your characters.
Sure. Yes.
Final question as we wrap it up. I'll just have each of you very briefly. When I walked out of the theater, I was just dumbfounded with the question of why do they hate us? I'm sort of curious for each of you, just briefly, when people walk out of the theater, what do you want them to be thinking about? I'll walk through it sort of in another order. Let me just, Kathy, let me start with you as the grandmother, the great, great, great grandmother here in the show. What do you as Kathy want people to walk out thinking about?
Where can we find our hope for the future?
Yeah. Alex, do you want people thinking about Harry Potter or no?
I want people to call their mother if they can and say, I love you.
Perfect. How sweet. Really important.
Matt? I call my mom as I drive to the theater every day, I call my mom.
That is really cool. I've lost my parents recently, and I got to tell you, that's a good thing to do. You never get that back. You never get it back. Max, what do you want people to think about?
I like Alex's answer. I'm going to stick with that. I feel like my family
has Alex's mom.
Yeah, everyone.
Yeah, Max calls my mom.
I call his mom every day. No, my family hasn't seen the show yet, and I feel like it's a really important show for families to see. And connection to the family, and same thing.
Is your sister going to come in to see it? And are you guys going to do a podcast about it?
We should. She's really fallen off the podcast game, but we'll get her back on.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, talk to Max about that. Mom, what do you want people to think?
I want people to think about how safe they really think they are and what they can do to make themselves and their families safer.
I just have to dig into that a little bit. Because we're not safe, or appreciate how safe we are? Which way did you mean that?
Yeah, appreciate the safety that they have and understand the difference between feeling safe and actually being safe. Because I think those are different. You can feel safe and not be safe, I guess. There's a lot of people doing that in this country. But then actually being safe, using the word safe a lot. It's just, it's almost, boy, in some countries, being safe is an abstract thing. Here, we take it for we take advantage of the fact because it's written into our constitution to be safe. But I think a lot of people do leave thinking, gee, am I safe? Do I need to be aware of that? What can I do to feel safer and make my family safer? These are questions that I'm hoping that they're coming away with.
Super. And Janet, from your past
fighting the noise of the garbage trucks outside. I want them to think to like you left thinking, you know, why do they hate us? I want people to think about why do they hate? Why do you hate? Why do I hate? Look at yourself, evolve and stop hating and see the connection that we all have and the importance of family and staying together and loving one another. I don't know. I just can't, you know. Yeah.
And Jeremy, I'm going to ask you that same question, but you get a little added on, which is you're the only person in this group who made the decision that this play would be presented. Everybody else auditioned, but you're the guy, maybe others as well, but you're the one who went, we're doing this. So what do you want people to think about? Because it's probably the same answer as why you're doing this.
The feelings that I have when I leave after seeing the show, which I've now seen 14 times or something, so I speak as an authority on the subject, is this real awareness that we all have to navigate a real complex situation. And this is a thing I really try to embrace in almost all of the work I direct, but I think around these subjects, the online rhetoric is particularly dim-witted. I think the governmental rhetoric is particularly dim-witted. I think everything is being reduced down to these simple questions and you know little sound bites and quips, and it does not serve us as individuals. It's actually a huge disservice to us culturally. So understanding the kind of the personal complexities, the political complexities, the historical complexities, and just being aware that this is the water in which we swim. We cannot, as humans today, get a simple answer for things. And I don't think we need it. I think simplicity is actually the enemy right now. The play invites lengthy, complicated discussion. I hear them erupting in the audience during every intermission. And as people exit, people are already working at the play and addressing it from all these sides. And that is the greatest opportunity that I think something like an art form like the theater can offer, is a chance for a deeper reflection and an invitation to experience something in the complexity of all human interaction that you can't get from, you know, at the moment from a Facebook or an Instagram interaction. It doesn't exist. That's not what those mediums are for. And the theater is the space where it is a larger space than we ourselves individually can be. And so participating in it, watching it, acting in it, working on it, forces us to expand our empathy and our understanding. And that is what I want people to feel, that stretch when they leave this
and
play.
On the bigger current, and thank you for that. And I need to end it there. I'm going to accept to say, I was struck by the fact that I'll say this as well without giving things away, but the French national anthem is sung at the end. And I found it intriguing. Not everybody sings it. And it's sort of interesting to take, I am correct in identifying that, right? That not everybody is singing it. And so when people see the show, if you haven't already, pay attention to who is and who isn't and why that might be the case. There's so much to this show. It's just so deep and really important for people to see. And I thank you all for being with me today. This was not easy to put together this quickly, but I was under a deadline for the TV end of things. And so for the PR people, Kathy Taylor and all those, man, and you guys all came through. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.